Section IV. Who is Israel by the promise? This experience of the Israelites, in departing from Egypt, was written for the instruction of those who should live in the last days. Before the overflowing scourge shall come upon the dwellers of the earth, the Lord calls upon all who are Israelites indeed to prepare for that event. Volume 6, page 195. The 12 tribes of Israel after the flesh are but type of Israel, by the promise the 144,000. As there were Gentiles among Israel the type, there would be Gentiles in Israel the true. The early part of the Christian church apostolic time could not be called Israel, for the history of the church then was typified by Isaac, according to Galatians 4:22-31, and as explained on pages 53, 54. Isaac was not called Israel, for he was the father of Jacob, and it was Jacob who was called Israel. Therefore, Israel, whatever part of the church it is, must come sometime later in the history of the church. Jacob was the father of the 12 tribes of Israel, and if Israel, after the flesh, is a type of Israel by promise the true, then let us study the beginning of Israel, after the flesh, if we are to locate, or know of Israel, by the promise, the 144,000. The journey of Israel down into Egypt could not have been an accident. Whatever the reason for it, God was in it. Joseph said to his brothers, Genesis 45:5, "Now therefore be not grieved, nor angry with yourselves, that ye sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life." Joseph declares that God was the cause for him going into Egypt. God had also told Abraham that he and his seed would sojourn and be afflicted in a strange land 430 years. But why did God send them into Egypt? Why was Joseph sold at the age of 17, merely a lad, into the hands of cruel Ishmaelites, and led to a strange land, to be resold, as a slave? We certainly would not make a mistake by thinking that Joseph became faint-hearted on the way. There surely must have been a reason for all this ill treatment. In Egypt, Joseph was sold to serve as a slave, and later was thrown into the dungeon for a number of years. Why did God lead Israel into that strange land, where idolatry prevailed everywhere? God certainly knew that in that land they would become slaves in just a short while. Why would heaven allow God's chosen people to become servants to a nation, whose idols were their gods? Why did God permit the lashes of the Egyptian taskmasters to be applied upon the backs of his people? Why would divine love permit the children of Abraham, God's friend, while yet in infancy, to be drowned in the river Nile? Who can say our great God was ignorant of all these things which took place, or that he made a mistake? The only answer that can be offered is that it was all heavenly designed. But what was it all about? God must have had some special reason and specific purpose for an object lesson, to be taught at a certain time. One may say, God did it all to show his power, but would the all-wise and great God, full of love and mercy, destroy his children to show his power? Not even an earthly, mortal, human father would dare destroy his children to show his power. Who would dare say human beings have greater love or better judgment and the great God, whose mercy is immeasurable, whose love fills the universe, whose wisdom is unsearchable, whose judgment is justice? Not only his chosen suffered of bondage and cruelty, but the Egyptians as well. At the time of the Exodus movement, at the departure of Israel, the plagues came upon all Egypt, and the nation was nearly ruined. On the night of the Passover, there was death in every dwelling, where there was no blood on the doorpost, and in every stall of beasts. And all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sitteth upon his throne, even unto the firstborn of the maidservant, that is behind the mill, and all the firstborn of beasts. Exodus 11:5. Israel journeyed to the Red Sea, and Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the waters were divided. Israel went into the sea, and walked across over dry ground. The Egyptians pursued after them to the midst of the sea, and Moses stretched his hand over the sea, the waters returned, and covered the chariots, horsemen, and all the host of Pharaoh which came into the sea. After them, there remained not so much as one of them. Israel came into the wilderness, where they wandered about for 40 years. Thousands of them perished because of unbelief. At the end of the wilderness journey, the people crossed the Jordan. During the time Israel was away from Canaan, the land was thickly inhabited by heathen nations. Israel was compelled to destroy them by the sword in order to possess the land. Think of the loss of life, grief, and suffering, all because God took Israel into Egypt and brought them back again. God certainly would not destroy His subjects just to show His power. In 1 Corinthians 10:11, 12, speaking of the experience of the children of Israel, we read, "Now all these things happened unto them for examples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Wherefore let him that thinketh he standeth take heed, lest he fall." If we are the people upon whom the end of the world is about to come, then their examples are written for our admonition. This is the reason why God led the children of Israel into Egypt and back again. Think how great the price to work out the picture. The lessons to be derived from these great examples are far greater than we have ever realized. Many thousands lost their lives to produce the picture, with the intention that many more thousands would be saved, and those who perished. Let us therefore carefully study into the lessons that were intended for our learning and admonition. Pharaoh dreamed, and, behold, he stood by the river. And, behold, there came up out of the river 7 well-favored kine, and fat-fleshed, and they fed in a meadow. And, behold, 7 other kine came up after them out of the river, ill-favored, and lean-fleshed, and stood by the other kine upon the brink of the river, and the ill-favored, and lean-fleshed kine did eat up the 7 well-favored, and fat kine. So Pharaoh awoke, and it came to pass in the morning, that his spirit was troubled, and he sent, and called for all the magicians of Egypt, and all the wise men thereof, and Pharaoh told them his dream, but there was none that could interpret them unto Pharaoh. Then Pharaoh sent, and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, "I have dreamed a dream, and there is none that can interpret it, and I have heard say of thee, that thou canst understand a dream to interpret it." And Pharaoh told the dream to Joseph. And Joseph said unto Pharaoh, "God hath showed Pharaoh what he is about to do. The 7 good kine are 7 years, and the 7th and ill-favored kine that came up after them are 7 years. Behold, there come 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt. And there shall arise after them 7 years of famine, and all the plenty shall be forgotten in the land of Egypt. And the plenty shall not be known in the land by reason of that famine following, for it shall be very grievous, and, in the 7 plenteous years the earth brought forth by handfuls. And he gathered up all the food of the 7 years, which were in the land of Egypt, and laid up the food in the cities, the food of the field, which was round about every city, laid he up in the same. And Joseph gathered corn, as the sand of the sea, very much, until he left numbering, for it was without number." Genesis 41:1-49. We shall endeavor to bring enough evidence in this study to show that Israel's experience in Egypt is a photograph of Israel, the true, the 144,000, in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. While the Exodus movement was a great movement, the Second Advent movement will be still greater. God will take out a people, not from one nation only, but from every nation under heaven, and He will lead them into the heavenly Canaan. This Advent movement, of which the Exodus movement was a type, we believe was foretold in prophecy in the following stirring language: "It shall come to pass in that day, that the Lord shall set His hand again the second time, to recover the remnant of His people, which shall be left. There shall be a highway for the remnant of His people, like as it was to Israel, in the day that he came up out of the land of Egypt." Review and Herald, October 10, 1929, pages 4, 5. The Exodus movement is in a way a type photograph of the closing work of God, under the Advent movement. Each movement rises in fulfillment of time prophecy. Certainties of the Advent Movement by W.A. Spicer. The fact that Israel after the flesh is a type photograph, their experience must be duplicated by the true, otherwise there can be no type. Years of plenty and famine. God permitted the plenty as well as the famine. Each one bears the number 7, meaning perfect or complete. These two sections of time can only mean one thing, which is none other than this world and history, into great divisions, namely B.C. and A.D., with the cross as the dividing line. The 7 years of plenty represent the Old Testament period, in which time God gave plenty, for by His holy prophets He stored it in the great storehouse, what we today call the Bible. In Matthew 11:13, we read, "For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John." It is for this reason that Jesus made the above statement, "For we have no other thus far." In the 7 years of plenty B.C., God stored His word in the Bible to feed the world Egypt in the next 7 years of famine A.D. God, who at sundry times and in divers manners spake in times past unto the fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us by His Son, whom He hath appointed heir of all things, by whom also He made the worlds. Hebrews 1:1, 2. The New Testament is the fulfillment of the Old. Joseph type of Christ. Joseph typified Christ. See Patriarchs and Prophets, pages 239-240. Our God in the Old Testament time 7 years of plenty spoke to His people in divers manners by His prophets, and commanded these things to be written, with the intention to speak to His people in these last days New Testament time, or 7 years of famine, to each one of us individually by the voice of His word, as found stored in the Bible. Thou shalt be over my house, and according unto thy word shall all my people be ruled, only in the throne will I be greater than thou. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, See, I have set thee over all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand, and put it upon Joseph's hand, and arrayed him in vestures of fine linen, and put a gold chain about his neck, and he made him to ride in the second chariot which he had, and they cried before him, Bowed the knee, and he made him ruler over all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without thee shall no man lift up his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. Genesis 41:40-44. No greater favor or honor could Pharaoh have shown to Joseph, and all the Egyptians bowed down to him. As we proceed in this study, we shall prove beyond a doubt that Joseph is a perfect type of Christ. Pharaoh, type of. If Joseph typified Christ, and Pharaoh honored Joseph above any man ever honored by any king, and Joseph and Pharaoh work hand in hand, then Pharaoh must stand for some figure or type. It would not be hard to determine what Pharaoh represents. That which honored Christ above everything that can be honored upon earth is what Pharaoh represents. The Church of the Apostles honored Christ above everything that can be honored, so much so that all sacrificed their lives. No greater homage has Christ received upon earth by any other part in the history of His church. By this we understand that Pharaoh represents the Apostles' Church, or organization. The application made here will prove correct as we advance in this study. Further explanation upon this subject is given on the last page of this section. The beginning of famine. The dividing line between the 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine is the cross. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John. Matthew 11:13. Where the 7 years of plenty end, the 7 years of famine begin. The first year of famine is the beginning of the Church of Christ at the time of the apostles. One may ask, why a famine in the beginning of the Christian Church? Did they not get sufficient corn truth? Yes, but they got it from the great storehouse, the Bible, in the same way as the Egyptians received their corn in the years of famine from the immense storehouse at the hand of Joseph. Egyptians, type of Gentiles. The 7 years of famine began when the Egyptians came to Pharaoh for bread, and Pharaoh told all the Egyptians, "Go unto Joseph, what he saith to you, do." And Joseph opened all the storehouses, and sold unto the Egyptians. Genesis 41:55-56. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt, and in the land of Canaan, for the corn which they bought. And Joseph brought the money unto Pharaoh's house. And when money failed in the land of Egypt, and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came unto Joseph, and said, "Give us bread, for why should we die in thy presence? For the money faileth." And they brought their cattle unto Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for horses, and for the flocks, and for the cattle of the herds, and for the asses, and he fed them with bread for all their cattle for that year. When that year was ended, they came unto him the second year, and said unto him, "We will not hide it from my lord, how that our money is spent. My lord also hath our herds of cattle. There is not aught left in the sight of my lord, but our bodies, and our lands. Wherefore shall we die before thine eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants unto Pharaoh." And Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For the Egyptians sold every man his field, and they said, "Thou hast saved our lives. Let us find grace in the sight of my lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants." Genesis 47:14-25. In the beginning of the famine, the Egyptians went to Pharaoh for corn, instead of to Joseph. They were well acquainted with Joseph, for he had been a governor of Egypt for 8 years or more. Joseph rode over all the land of Egypt, and every Egyptian bowed down to him. During the years of plenty, it was Joseph who bought the corn from the Egyptians, and it seems strange that they should go to Pharaoh. It must have been by divine providence that they came to him. It has been explained that Pharaoh represented the church organization or leadership. The Egyptians cannot represent anything else but the Gentiles in the days of the apostles. The Gentiles came to the church Pharaoh, where they were told to go to Joseph Christ. "What he saith to you, do." That is, the church in her purity, without one strange thing in their midst, directed the Gentiles to Christ as their life-giver, as Pharaoh directed the Egyptians to Joseph. Egyptians sold themselves to Pharaoh. And Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for the Egyptians sold every man his field, because the famine prevailed over them, so the land became Pharaoh's. Genesis 47:20. In the preceding verses of the chapter we read the Egyptians spent all their money for corn. And when the money was gone, they gave the cattle in exchange, and when the cattle were gone, they gave the land, and when the land was gone, they sold themselves, and became servants to Pharaoh. This is the type, but of the fulfillment of this type, we read in the following texts, "And the multitude of them that believed were of one heart, and of one soul. Neither said any of them, that aught of the things which he possessed was his own, but they had all things common. And with great power gave the apostles witness of the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and great grace was upon them all. Neither was there any among them that lacked, for as many as were possessors of lands or houses sold them, and brought the prices of the things that were sold, and laid them down at the apostles' feet." And Hoseas, who by the apostles was surnamed Barnabas, a Levite, having land, sold it, and brought the money, and laid it at the apostles' feet. Acts 4:32-37. Thus Jew and Gentile sold all houses and lands, and brought the prices, and laid them at the apostles' feet, and became servants to the church Pharaoh. Again we read Acts 5:1-10, "But a certain man named Ananias, with Sapphira his wife, sold a possession, and kept back part of the price, his wife also being privy to it, and brought a certain part, and laid it at the apostles' feet. But Peter said, Ananias, why hath Satan filled thine heart, to lead to the Holy Ghost, and to keep back part of the price of the land?" And Ananias, hearing these words, fell down, and gave up the ghost. Thus any who pretended to sell, and held back part of the price received in the days of the apostles, died just as those who would not sell all to Pharaoh in Egypt. Jesus said, "Sell all and follow me." Therefore type met anti-type. Joseph removes people throughout Egypt. And Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, and as for the people, he removes them to cities from one end of the borders of Egypt even to the other end thereof. Genesis 47, part of verses 20, 21. This is the type. Following is the fulfillment of the type. Acts 8, 1. And Saul was consenting unto his Stephen's death. And at that time there was a great persecution against the church which was at Jerusalem. And they were all scattered abroad throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles. It will be noticed that the apostles were at home Jerusalem. And there is no record where the apostles sold their land. Now we quote the type of the latter, Genesis 47:22, only the land of the priests bought he not, for the priests had a portion assigned them of Pharaoh, and did eat their portion which Pharaoh gave them, wherefore they sold not their lands. It is remarkable to note how this coincides to the smallest details. 70 souls, type of organization. Israel arrived in Egypt in the second year of famine. Genesis 45:10-11, and thou shalt dwell in the land of Goshen, and thou shalt be near unto me, thou, and thy children, and thy children's children, and thy flocks, and thy herds, and all that thou hast, and there will I nourish thee, for yet there are 5 years of famine, lest thou, and thy household, and all that thou hast, come to poverty. The arrival of Israel in Egypt stands for some symbol in which there must be a lesson. Note that this lesson cannot be for the early part of the Christian church, for Israel came in the second year of famine. The lesson, then, intended here, is for a later period in the history of the church. If we are to know the truth of the incident, and the lesson intended to be derived from it, reference must here be made to the number of souls which entered into Egypt. And the sons of Joseph, which were born him in Egypt, were 2 souls. All the souls of the house of Jacob, which came into Egypt, were 70. Genesis 46:27. The Bible says all the souls who came into Egypt were 70 in number. If we can in some way find the meaning of the number, then we shall understand the lesson. When Moses, with the children of Israel, came to Sinai, he organized the church there, and in organizing, selected 70 elders. This same organization, years later, crossed the Jordan and went into the Promised Land. There they had the Sanhedrin, which was composed of 70 men. Thus, the number 70 is a symbol of church organization. The meaning, then, is that there will be a church organization sometime in the history of AD. If this is true, then that church which Christ, with the apostles, organized must disband and of necessity be reorganized. This is true, for the Christian church was disorganized in the Dark Ages during the time of the beginning of papal rule. When again organized, it would partially fulfill Joel 2:32, and, in the remnant, whom the Lord shall call. The 2300 days, or years, of Daniel's prophecy in the 8th chapter gives us the entire truth of church history to 1844, until which time there was no call for reorganization. If there had been, or if this call for reorganization had met its fulfillment before 1844, then Daniel's prophecy would have made mention of it. As the prophecy is silent, and there has no prophet of God risen since the church fell into papal power about AD 538 to 1844, then the truth of the symbol was yet in the future. As the prophetic period ended in 1844, the most holy place, in the heavenly sanctuary, was opened, into which Christ entered. If this incident marked the beginning of the atonement, there would have been no better or more opportune time for a call from heaven, and at the end of the great prophetic period, the Day of Atonement being the most solemn time for the church. Seventh-day Adventists were called out by a prophet, and are practically the only people who believe in the 2300 days. We are the only people who have proclaimed it since 1844, and are now in the atonement, or the time of the judgment. The text for this is here quoted, "And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel, to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation, and kindred, and tongue, and people, saying with a loud voice, Fear God, and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment is come, and worship Him that made heaven, and earth, and the sea, and the fountains of waters." Revelation 14:6-7. Seventh-day Adventists only can fulfill the type, for just at this time they were called by a prophet of God to organize as a denomination and to proclaim the glad news, this gospel, in all the world in this generation. Thus the symbol 70 met its fulfillment at that time. Still another thought on the experience of Israel: when Joseph's brethren came into Egypt, they went directly to him for corn. And Joseph's brethren came, and bowed down themselves before him with their faces to the earth. Genesis 42:6. The sons of Jacob were strangers in the land, and knew not their brother, who was a governor. They providentially came not to Pharaoh, as the Egyptians did, for corn, but directly to the right person, Joseph. In contrast to this, the Egyptians, who should have known better, being acquainted with the rule of their country, went to Pharaoh for corn, but their king told them to go to Joseph. What he saith to you, do. The Egyptians must have known Joseph, being their governor for more than 8 years by that time. In the 7 years of plenty, it was Joseph to whom they sold the food which he preserved for the time of famine. Joseph rode in Pharaoh's chariot over all the land of Egypt, and all the Egyptians bowed down to him, thus it would have been impossible for them to be ignorant of him. This being a symbol, it can only find its fulfillment in the following narrative. The Egyptians Gentiles went to Pharaoh leadership of the apostolic church for corn. The apostles directed the Gentiles converts to Christ as Pharaoh directed the Egyptians to Joseph, saying, Go to Joseph. What he saith to you, do. If this is the meaning we get from the Egyptians going to Pharaoh, then the significance of the sons of Jacob going directly to Joseph means that when that church is reorganized, the people would have to go directly to Christ Joseph. The lesson intended is that in the beginning of the church in 1845, which had no true leadership Pharaoh to go to, they of necessity went directly to Christ, as the sons of Jacob came to Joseph. Jacob type of James. The Seventh-day Adventist Church, which came into existence in 1845, became Israel, the movement from which the true Israel, the 144,000, are made. It will be noticed that the names of the fathers, after the flesh and by the promise, coincide. The father's name of Israel after the flesh was Jacob. So is the name of the father of Israel by the promise Seventh-day Adventist movement. But one may say, it was Jacob in the former, and James White in the latter. True it is, but the names Jacob and James are the same. Again, the very first vision Sister White had was about the 144,000, and the aim of this denomination has been to make that number. The land of Goshen. The beginning of this denomination was typified by Israel's entrance into Egypt as previously explained. We shall now consider the truth of the land of Goshen. Joseph brought Israel into Egypt, and gave them the part of the land to dwell in which was the best land in the country of Egypt, and there Joseph nourished them, their flocks, herds, and cattle, and all they had. See Genesis 45:10. The land of Goshen stands as a symbol of the United States of America, in which the church came into existence. While our country is productive like the land of Goshen, the richest in the world and a Protestant nation, it is the best for missionary work, for it is made up of all nations, and therefore like the land of Goshen, the most productive in Egypt the world. Joseph nourished Israel. In the beginning of the 7 years of famine the Egyptians sold all, and became servants to Pharaoh, which has reference to the Apostles' Church, and of the Gentiles then, who sold their houses and lands and had all things in common, as previously explained. But Israel did not sell any of their possessions, nor did they pay for the food with which Joseph nourished them. Israel, then, represents the church now. In the beginning of the church in 1845, Christ Joseph opened the storehouse and gave us all the truth corn we could possibly assimilate. Is it not a fact that no other people at any time in the history of the church have received as much truth as God has given us in our time? Line upon line, precept upon precept, instruction upon instruction have been given us so that we, as a people, may know and understand the ways of the Lord, obey His voice, keep His charge, commandments, statutes, and laws, thus becoming the children of Abraham, and heirs according to the promise. When this is realized in the hearts of men, then they will fulfill the charge given to Peter. Peter said, "Thou knowest I love thee." Jesus saith unto him, "Feed my sheep." Shepherds. And Pharaoh said unto his brethren Joseph's, "What is your occupation?" And they said unto Pharaoh, "Thy servants are shepherds, both we, and also our fathers." Genesis 47:3. Israel were shepherds, which is a symbol of missionaries such as feed the lambs of God. In the early part of the church, the byword was, every Seventh-day Adventist a missionary, and every missionary a preacher. It ought to be so now. The great struggle has not been between religion and no religion. It is between God's religion and man's religion. Review and Heralds, January 23, 1930. Another Pharaoh arose. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. Exodus 1:8. If the first Pharaoh, who exalted Joseph Christ, represented the leadership in the days of the apostles, then this new Pharaoh must represent the leadership of this present movement at the time this subject became known. Note, this new Pharaoh knew not Joseph Christ. The meaning is that the leadership of this organization has left following their master, Christ. Volume 5, page 217. Grievous and presumptuous sins have dwelt among us. And yet the general opinion is that the church is flourishing, and that peace and spiritual prosperity are in all her borders. The church have turned back from following Christ her leader, and is steadily retreating toward Egypt. Yet few are alarmed or astonished at their want of spiritual power. Doubt and even disbelief of the testimonies of the Spirit of God is leavening our churches everywhere. Satan would have it thus. The testimonies are unread and unappreciated. Further explanation of the Pharaohs being types is given on the last page of this section. Taskmasters. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And he said unto his people, "Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we, therefore they did set over them taskmasters, to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom, and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar, and in brick, and in all manner of service in the field." Exodus 1:8-13. The children of Israel, said Pharaoh, are too strong and mightier than we. Let us deal wisely and reduce their strength. So the Israelites were drafted from the sheepfolds to the brickyards and the field, but this did not reduce their strength. Said Pharaoh, "Let us set taskmasters over them to wear them out." Note the application. Pharaoh is the king, the one who rules. The taskmasters in this case could be none other than a class of ministers referred to in Volume 5, page 217. Doubt and even disbelief of the testimonies of the Spirit of God is leavening our churches everywhere. Satan would have it thus. Ministers who preach self instead of Christ would have it thus. The testimonies are unread and unappreciated. No longer is the byword of Seventh-day Adventists, every Seventh-day Adventist a missionary, every missionary a preacher, as what it used to be. But how much per capita? Or, have you made your budget? Instead of, have you brought any souls to Christ? Are your church members nearer to Him? It is not meant here that Christians ought not to give for the support of the cause. We ought to give, and give more liberally than we have given in the past, but our gifts ought to come from a willing heart, and not from the result of lashes. The people should be fed with spiritual food so that they would feel the need of giving without overbearing on the subject. When Moses was about to build the sanctuary in the wilderness, God commanded him, saying, "Speak unto the children of Israel, that they bring me an offering of every man that giveth it willingly with his heart, ye shall take my offering." Moses was commanded to take offerings only from those who willingly gave from their heart. We are told by the spirit of prophecy that ministers should not put all their efforts and time with the church. Members are not to expect a sermon every Sabbath. Ministers should rather engage themselves in working for outsiders. Read Volume 9, page 140. Have we taken heed to this instruction? For example, we have scores of ministers in Los Angeles and immediate vicinity, but how many public efforts have we? It was announced just a short time ago that there were only two. Thus it has been for some years. What are these ministers doing day after day, and week after week? It seems they are doing nothing but preparing a sermon during 6 days of the week to preach on Sabbath, and then it is either something to sell or some particular budget to raise. How many sermons preached do we read of in the Bible urging people to give money or to buy something to support the cause? Not one. We have polluted the house of God with merchandise even on Sabbath morning, which hour is dedicated as a day of rest to worship God. Volume 1, pages 471, 472, a great mistake has been made by some who profess present truth by introducing merchandise in the course of a series of meetings and by their traffic diverting minds from the object of the meetings. If Christ were now upon earth, he would drive out these peddlers and traffickers, whether they be ministers or people, with a scourge of small cords, as when he entered the temple anciently. Ministers have stood in the desk and preached a most solemn discourse, and then by introducing merchandise and acting the part of a salesman, even in the house of God, they have diverted the minds of their hearers from the impressions received and destroyed the fruit of their labor. Their time and strength should be held in reserve, that their efforts may be thorough in a series of meetings. Their time and strength should not be drawn upon to sell our books, when they can be properly brought before the public by those who have not the burden of preaching the word culpators. It is written, "My house shall be called the house of prayer, but ye have made it a den of thieves." These traffickers might have pleaded, as an excuse, that the articles they held for sale were for sacrificial offerings. But their object was to get gain, to obtain means, to accumulate. Volume 1, page 472. Our conference is not ignorant of the instruction here given, and the evil which is practiced in the churches. At the Autumn Council held in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in 1923, the question of book sales on the Sabbath day was brought forth in connection with other matters, and the following resolution was passed and published, that all campaigns for the promotion of periodicals or book sales on the Sabbath day be eliminated, and that those responsible for the promotion of these campaigns be directed to the method of house-to-house solicitation by visiting committees in connection with campaigns for literature sales. That we invite our publishing houses to exercise caution circularizing our people on behalf of publishing house projects, and to refrain from sending to church officers matters to be presented on the Sabbath, with previous arrangements with the local, union, and general conferences. Milwaukee Autumn Council, October 9, 17, 1923. Review and Herald of November 22, 1923. Read Volume 9, page 260. We read in Testimonies to Ministers, page 477, a strange thing has come into our churches. Men who are placed in positions of responsibility, that they may be wise helpers to their fellow workers, have come to suppose that they were set as kings and rulers in the churches to say to one brother, "Do this," to another, "Do that," and to another, "Be sure to labor in such and such a way." Thus Pharaoh has drafted the people from the sheepfold to the brickyards, or the field. The taskmasters, being commanded to oversee the work, urge the bricks budgets, and wear out the people. The existing sins in the church are passed over and no one cares. Those who do approve wrongs incur their displeasure. In Volume 3, page 266, speaking of the condition in the church at the time of the sealing marking of the 144,000, and the slaughter in the church, we read, "Those who have excused these wrongs have been thought by the people to be very amiable and lovely in disposition, simply because they shunned a discharge of plain scriptural duty. The task was not agreeable to their feelings, therefore they avoided it. Furnish straw no more." And Pharaoh commanded the same day the taskmasters of the people, and their officers, saying, "Ye shall no more give the people straw to make brick, as heretofore. Let them go, and gather straw for themselves." And the taskmasters of the people went out and their officers, and they spake to the people, saying, "Thus saith Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go ye, get you straw where ye can find it, yet not aught of your work shall be diminished." Exodus 5, 6, 7, 10, 11. Pharaoh will not furnish straw, that is, he will not render any help, but the people must produce the same amount of bricks. In the beginning of this organization, Seventh-day Adventists, the denominational institutions, sanitariums, and hospitals were built for the purpose of caring for our own people, members of the church. After the cause of the patient had been diagnosed, the cause being made known, with instruction, some aid or treatments were to be given. This help was to be rendered, whether they were able to pay much, little, or nothing. Such is the work of the Good Samaritan. In former numbers of testimonies for the church, I have spoken of the importance of the Seventh-day Adventists establishing an institution for the benefit of the sick, especially for the suffering and sick among us. I have spoken of the ability of our own people, in point of means, to do this, and have urged that, in view of the importance of this branch of the great work of preparation to meet the Lord, when I saw those who managed and directed running into the dangers shown me, of which I had warned them in public and also in private conversation and letters, a terrible burden came upon me, that which had been shown me as a place where the suffering sick among us could be helped was one where sacrifice, hospitality, faith, and piety should be the ruling principles. But when unqualified calls were made for large sums of money, with the statement that stock taken would pay large percent, when the brethren who occupied positions in the institution seemed more than willing to take large wages, and those were satisfied with who filled other and equally important stations in the great cause of truth and reform, when I learned, with pain, that, in order to make the institution popular with those not of our faith and to secure their patronage, a spirit of compromise was rapidly gaining ground at the Institute, manifested in the use of Mr., Miss., and Mrs., instead of Bro. and Sister, and in popular amusements, in which all could engage in a sort of comparatively innocent frolic. When I saw these things, I said, "This is not that which was shown me as an institution for the sick, which would share the signal blessing of God. This is another thing." And yet calculations for more extensive buildings were made, and calls for large sums of money were urged. As it was then managed, I could but regard the Institute, on the whole, as a curse. Several who came to Battle Creek humble, devoted, confiding Christians, went away almost infidels. The general influence of these things was creating prejudice against the health reform, and very many of the most humble, the most devoted, and the best of our brethren, and was destroying faith in my testimonies and in the present truth. The brethren who have stood at the head of this work have appealed to our people for means, on the ground that the health reform is a part of the great work connected with the third angel's message. In this they have been right. It is a branch of the great, charitable, liberal, sacrificing, benevolent work of God. Then why should these brethren say, "Stock in the Health Institute will pay a large percent, it is a good investment, a paying thing"? Why not as well talk of stock and the publishing association paying a large percent? If these are two branches of the same great closing work of preparation for the coming of the Son of Man, why not? Or why not make them both matters of liberality? The pen and the voice that appealed to the friends of the cause in behalf of the publishing fund held out no such inducements. Volume 1, pages 633-636. How do our institutions now measure with this stray testimony? Can we say they are charitable, liberal, sacrificing, benevolent institutions? Listen to the enormous profits they make. Presentment is here made of the annual report of ESTI, Helena Sanitarium, as it appeared in the Pacific Union Recorder of April 25, 1929. The notes payable at the end of 1925 were $60,044. The cents are not here given. In 1926, they had been reduced to $49,031, in 1927 to $36,321, and at the close of 1928, they were down to $26,415. In 3 years, they were reduced from $60,000 to $33,629. Resources, fixed and current, at the close of 1928, $371,105. The liabilities, $45,809. There is a decrease in the liabilities of nearly $5,000. Cash on hand at the close of 1928, $10,749. Present worth, $325,296. The gross income, $456,258. The net income, $437,284. The average daily attendance of patients was 85, plus, and the income from patients direct, $261,363. The net gain, $10,439.39. How could it be possible for an institution to do any charitable work at all, and yet earn $111,988 above its present worth in one single year? Note, present worth, $325,296. Net income, $437,284 in 1928. But this is not the worst. Our brethren have gone so blind that they think these enormous profits give them a wonderful credit for their wise management, and boast over it, and say that the sanitarium is facing sunshine. Truly our God knew what He was saying when He said, "The Laodiceans are blind, wretched, and miserable, and poor, and naked, though they think they are rich and increased with goods, and have need of nothing." See the contrast of boasting between the Laodiceans and other institutions of whom some often think the devil is their leader. Following is the annual report of a mission in Los Angeles for the corresponding year 1928, these items being given free of charge to the needy. The annual report for the year ending December 31, 1928, shows 527,481 meals served, 137,287 lodgings furnished, laundry service, 53,334 pieces, barber service, 20,394, baths, 12,339, garments distributed, 32,541, 1,791 shoes repaired, employment secured for 9,204 individuals. Medical aid given to 3,117, while the chapel report shows that during the year 15,340 persons professed salvation in the daily meetings, which are continuous from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. and are conducted by groups from the churches of all denominations. Copied from a Los Angeles newspaper. Is the devil become more charitable than Christ? Why have we gone to sleep? Is it dollars and cents that the Lord wants? Are these things not destroying the confidence of the public in the people of God? Are these things adding or detracting from the fruit of our labor? Are we representing God and carrying the third angel's message to a dying world? Is Christ our pattern and example? Why have we allowed the devil to deceive us? Is not this a call to arouse the people of God to a Christ-like service? How long shall we stay asleep? It is bad enough for God's people to turn down one who is not in the faith from receiving the benefits of God at the hand of his people. But it is 1,000 times worse to turn down one of Israel, he who would sacrifice and cast his lot with the people of God, faithful in tithe-paying and offerings as the Lord has prospered. If God should permit poverty to overtake such a one with sickness or old age, what do we do with them? Do we send them away and tell them, God bless thee? Is the country hospital for God's people and God's hospitals for money-making? Is the county farm for God's people, there with the ungodly and with the unclean on their table, as we believe from a religious standpoint, amidst profanity, swine, and tobacco? Is this the kind of place for the child of God and the temple of the Holy Ghost according to our faith? What kind of answer will we give him when he comes? Will we hear the words, "Well done, good and faithful servant," as we read in Matthew 25:35-36? For I was an hungered, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. Shall the saying be ours, or will we find ourselves at the left hand with the terrible curse, as in Matthew 25:41-43, 46, Depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels? For I was an hungered, and ye gave me no meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me not in. Naked, and ye clothed me not. Sick, and in prison, and ye visited me not. And these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal. Quoting Volume 1, page 639, as early as 1850 this brother became a Sabbath keeper. And from that date he contributed liberally to the several enterprises that have been undertaken to advance the cause, till he became reduced in property. Yet when the urgent, unqualified call came for the Institute, he took stock to the amount of $100. At the meeting at he introduced the case of his wife, who is very feeble, and who can be helped, but must be helped soon, if ever. He also stated his circumstances, and said that if he could command the $100 then in the Institute, he could send his wife there to be treated, but, as it was, he could not. We replied that he should never have invested a dollar in the Institute, that there was a wrong in the matter which we could not help, and there the matter dropped. I do not hesitate to say that this sister should be treated, a few weeks at least, at the Institute free of charge. Her husband is able to do but little more than to pay her fare to and from Battle Creek. Do we have such cases as these at the present time? Do we deal with these people like some farmer deals with his horse? He takes good care of the horse while it is young and doing his work, but when the animal gets old and feeble, he then drives it out in the open field, in the winter weather, just at the time the poor horse needs the best of care. Are we not like this hard-hearted farmer, who starves his horse in the winter weather, with the frost on the back of the worn-out animal, to save a few bundles of straw? Cruel, is it not? It is left to the reader to answer the question. Midwives. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel, and the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, and he said, When ye do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women, if it be a son, then ye shall kill him, but if it be a daughter, then she shall live. Exodus 1:12-15-16. The midwives symbolize the church school teachers, who nurse the children in the system of education. You may ask, is it possible that the devil would attempt to deceive the teachers and poison the children's minds? The devil is not leaving one string loose. References here made to the Home and School Journal of Christian Education, of DEC, 1929, published by the General Conference of Seventh-day Adventists, Washington, D.C., and every teacher in the denomination is supposed to be a subscriber of this magazine. The above-mentioned issue is full of Christmas stories, Christmas keeping, and Christmas programs and gifts which the teachers are supposed to pass on to the children. As it would be too lengthy to quote it all, only the very last sentence and the closing words under the paragraph "What Christmas May Always Mean" is quoted here, and, in general, a baptism of reality, simplicity, and sincerity in the observance of the world's supreme birthday. Think of these words, dear reader. A Seventh-day Adventist paper, published by the General Conference to exalt the world's supreme idolatrous day to a birthday of Christ and hand it to the teachers of the denomination. But the midwives feared God, and did not, as the king of Egypt commanded them, but save them and children alive. Exodus 1:17. Here we have one good symbol, and let us say, Amen, for the teachers they feared God. We urge you to send your children to the school of the denomination, for it is the best place for them. The name of the one was Shiphrah, and the name of the other Puah. Exodus 1:15. The meaning of these names are beauty and splendor. Indeed it is. It would have been impossible for two midwives to wait on the great multitude of women, but the fact is that there were only two. The reason for this is to make the symbol perfect, meaning both classes of teachers, male and female, beauty and splendor. Male children in the Nile. Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed very mighty. Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, Every son that is born ye shall cast into the river, and every daughter ye shall save alive. Exodus 1:20-22. The chief object of Pharaoh's scheme was not to reduce the people in number. Had this been his aim, he should have killed the female, for in those days they practiced polygamy. Had he given an order to cast the female children in the river and save the males, he could have accomplished his purpose and also added to his slaves, for it was the men who produced the bricks. We read in Patriarchs and Prophets, page 242, Satan was the mover in this matter. He knew that a deliverer was to be raised up among the Israelites, and by leading the king to destroy their children he hoped to defeat the divine purpose. This was the object of the whole affair. As this is a symbol, the application will now be made. Testimonies to Ministers, page 475, under the chapter entitled Let Heaven Guide We Read, Prophecy Must Be Fulfilled. The Lord says, Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet, before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. Somebody is to come in the spirit and power of Elijah, and when he appears, men may say, You are too earnest, you do not interpret the scriptures in the proper way. Let me tell you how to teach your message. No plainer statement could have been made, and this, that we must look for a prophet or a message in the near future. If this is an inspired statement, then it seems it would be the duty of the watchman on the walls of Zion to educate and instruct the people that there is a prophet or a message to look for. But what have we? On the contrary, the general opinion of the entire denomination is, no prophet cometh, neither is there any message to be expected. We have all the truth, and we need none, is the cry from the camp of Israel. Thus we see how the old enemy has duplicated his underhand deception with the church at the present time. Just as Pharaoh was unconscious of the main purpose of his command, just so by the unconsciousness of the leaders, the shrewd deceiver has attempted to drown the prophet or the message of reform for the present time. Thus it proves in every instance that the experience of Israel in Egypt is a photograph of Israel, the true. If a prophet or even a message should come, the church is not ready to accept either. The result may be the same as it was with the Jewish nation and the coming of Christ. How terrible the thought! While it seemed to the Egyptians in the interests of the empire to hold these people in bondage, the real purpose behind it all was the determination of Satan, the dragon power, Isaiah 51:9, to hold the people of Israel in the bondage of sin, and to prevent the work of reform to which God had set his hand as the time of the prophecy came. Review and Herald, January 23, 1930. Male children of denomination, how drowned? Has the devil drowned any of the male children in the River Nile at this time? Where are the men in this denomination? They must be in the River Nile, for it is a symbol of the sins in the world, and that is where we generally find the men and the women in the church. The question may be asked, what sifted out the men? The spirit of prophecy teaches that we should see to it that employment is furnished to newcomers, in the truth, to make it possible for them to keep the Sabbath. Also to take care of the poor and sick among us. This instruction has been altogether disregarded, with the result that the men are sifted out of the church. Men love the truth as much as women do, but as soon as they hear the truth, they begin to inquire about things. Immediately the difficulty arises, and the question is asked, how can I keep the Sabbath, and yet hold my position? If I should let my position go, can I secure another? Would the church help me find something to do? Would the church render some assistance in case of great need, such as lack of food, clothing, or in case of sickness? All these questions are answered at once with, number, the result is, the decision is made, and the truth is turned down. If the church had furnished some encouragement along these lines, this position would not have been taken by these newly interested parties, and the result would have been that the men as well as the women would have been in the church. Men being the wage earners, the increase of tithes and offerings cannot be estimated, and the little expenditure in helps would be but a fragment in comparison. Employment agency would be a great field to the denomination. Not only employment would have been secured from people outside of the organization, but the work among Adventists would be secured by Adventists. Thus the men are cast into the World Nile, but the women left alive in the church. Moses found by princess, quoting Exodus 2:2-3, and the woman conceived and bare a son. And, when she saw him that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. And when she could not longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes, and daubed it with slime, and with pitch, and put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the river's brink. Providence led the Egyptian princess to the river to wash herself, and after seeing the ark, she sent her maid to fetch it. She saw that the babe wept, and she had compassion on him. The sister of the babe stepped to Pharaoh's daughter, and said, shall I go, and call to thee a nurse of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for thee? On the arrival of the child's mother, Pharaoh's daughter said, take this child away, and nurse it for me. And the child grew, and she brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter, at the age of 12, and the princess named him Moses. The lesson here is, with all the satanic schemes, it would be impossible to defeat the divine purpose. Moses' choice. As Moses the type received the highest education the courts of Pharaoh could produce, after becoming of age he was compelled to choose one of two things, either the throne of Egypt, or to suffer affliction with the children of Israel. Just so, modern Moses the antitype receives the highest education the denomination can produce when of age finished education, professor. Modern Moses says, well, being compelled to choose one of two things, either professor, in the world Egypt, with a large income, fame, and the pleasures of sin for a season, or to work for the denomination with a small salary, and suffer affliction with the church, the children of Israel. As Moses the type chose the latter, just so Moses the antitype prefers to stay with the denomination, esteeming the reproach of Christ's greater riches and the treasures of Egypt. The statistics of the movement, so we are told, show that 90% of the children who go to schools of the denomination remain true to the message. This proves the lesson taught here is correct. Moses' misconception. And it came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown, that he went out unto his brethren, and he spied an Egyptian smiting an Hebrew. He slew the Egyptian, and hid him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together, and he said to him that did the wrong, "Wherefore smitest thou thy fellow?" And he said, "Who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as thou killedst the Egyptian?" And Moses feared, but Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh, and dwelt in the land of Midian. Exodus 2:11-15. Moses supposed he was to deliver the children of Israel by force or arms, therefore he rolled up his sleeves, and went about his duty. Moses' misconception of the method to be used in the deliverance of Israel was not the only thing wrong with the man. If that was the way he understood Israel was to obtain their freedom, he failed to carry out the plan. His trouble was not because of lack of education or training as a general of armies that he failed to carry out his project, but because he was too cowardly and feared Pharaoh. If this was not the cause of his failure, why then kill only one Egyptian, bury him in the sand, and after it was made known, run away, and leave Israel to perish in slavery? If his intention, or understanding, was to lead Israel against the armies of Egypt, he should not have hidden the Egyptian in the sand, but left him upon the ground for an example, and then go after others. Failing to carry out his proposed scheme, Moses made a double mistake. This ancient Moses is a symbol of modern Moses' present leadership. As Moses' failure was not because of lack of training, but because of a misconceived idea of the method to be carried out, just so with the leadership now. As Moses failed to accomplish his own mistake and plan what he supposed was wise judgment, just so the leadership have now failed on their part. The aim has been to finish the work in this generation which is practically past, and at the rate of speed the work is going now, it could not be finished in another 100 years. We are in danger of trusting to methods, organization, and high-pressure service, which if taken alone, can, in the end, result only in confusion, dissatisfaction, and defeat. Review and Herald, Feb. 20, 1930. The application of the type. If Pharaoh is the king, the leadership, who rules over the people, then the church is the queen, then the princess is the church school. Egypt is a symbol of the world, and the Nile a symbol of the sins of the world. By the aid of the God-fearing mother, Moses the type was not cast into the river Nile. Just so with modern Moses, who, by the help of his Christian mother, is saved from the river Nile, the sin in the world, but when she cannot keep him any longer, and must send him to the schools of the land, where sin reigns, the church school, the princess finds him. As Moses the type received his education by the aid of the princess, just so modern Moses receives his education by the aid of the church school. We, like Moses, have thought that we are to deliver Israel by force of arms, the aid of men. Like Moses, we are too cowardly to accomplish anything. It has been said by a good minister of God, "This is wrong in the church, and that is not right, and should be corrected, but we cannot do it." Why? Because he is afraid he will lose his job. But what shall we do? Work for God and trust in Him, or work for Pharaoh and trust in the job? Quoting Volume 5, pages 80-82, but the days of purification of the church are hastening on apace. God will have a people pure and true. In the mighty sifting soon to take place, we shall be better able to measure the strength of Israel. The signs reveal that the time is near when the Lord will manifest that His fan is in His hand, and He will thoroughly purge His floor. Those who have trusted to intellect, genius, or talent will not then stand at the head of rank and file. They did not keep pace with the light. Those who have proved themselves unfaithful will not then be entrusted with the flock. In the last solemn work few great men will be engaged. They are self-sufficient, independent of God, and He cannot choose them. The Lord has faithful servants, who in the shaking, testing time will be disclosed to view. There are precious ones now hidden who have not bowed the knee to Baal. They have not had the light which has been shining in a concentrated blaze upon you. But, it may be under a rough and uninviting exterior, the pure brightness of a genuine Christian character will be revealed. In this time, the gold will be separated from the dross in the church. Many a star, that we have admired for its brilliancy, will then go out in darkness. The most weak and hesitating in the church will be as David, willing to do and dare. Then will the church of Christ appear, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, and terrible as an army with banners. God will work a work in our day that but few anticipate. He will raise up and exalt among us those who are taught rather by the unction of His Spirit than by the outward trading of scientific institutions. These facilities are not to be despised or condemned. They are ordained of God, but they can furnish only the exterior qualifications. God will manifest that He is not dependent on learned, self-important mortals. Moses in the wilderness. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and the priest of Midian gave Moses Zipporah his daughter to wife. Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert, and came to the mountain of God, Horeb, and, behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. God called unto him out of the midst of the bush, and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here am I. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians. Come now therefore, and I will send thee unto Pharaoh, that thou mayest bring forth my people the children of Israel out of Egypt. And Moses said unto God, Who am I, that I should go unto Pharaoh? And Moses said unto the Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither heretofore, nor since thou hast spoken unto thy servant, but I am slow of speech, and of a slow tongue. I am of uncircumcised lips, and how shall Pharaoh hearken unto me? And the Lord said unto him, Who hath made man's mouth? Or who maketh the dumb, or deaf, or the seeing, or the blind? Have not I the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be thy mouth, and teach thee what thou shalt say. And the Lord said unto him, What is that in thine hand? And he said, A rod. And he said, Cast it on the ground. And he cast it on the ground, and it became a serpent, and Moses fled from before it. And the Lord said unto Moses, Put forth thine hand, and take it by the tail. And he put forth his hand, and caught it, and it became a rod in his hand. And he said, O my Lord, send, I pray thee, by the hand of him whom thou wilt send. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. Read Exodus 2:15-4:13. Application of the lesson. This last Moses is the unlearned Moses. Note, he is slow of speech, has no eloquences of a slow tongue, and uncircumcised lips untrained. He knows not how to approach Pharaoh. He shrinks with the thought of standing before the great monarch, like the mercury shrinks from the north wind. But though this Moses is handicapped, he has nerve, he is not a coward. He risks his life, for he was asked only once to take the fabulous serpent by the tail, and he did so. This Moses is not a crown prince, but a common shepherd only. The shepherd Moses is a type of men who are to bring about reformation and be used in the time of the loud cry brought to view in the following quotations. Quoting Life Sketches, page 245, God is putting burdens upon more inexperienced shoulders. He is fitting them to be caretaking, to venture, to run risks also. Volume 5, page 82, He will raise up and exalt among us those who are taught rather by the unction of His Spirit than by the outward trading of scientific institutions. Testimonies to Ministers, page 300, Unless those who can help them are aroused to a sense of their duty, they will not recognize the work of God when the loud cry of the third angel shall be heard. When light goes forth to lighten the earth, instead of coming up to the help of the Lord, they will want to bind about His work to meet their narrow ideas. Let me tell you that the Lord will work in this last work in a manner very much out of the common order of things, and in a way that will be contrary to any human planning. There will be those among us who will always want to control the work of God, to dictate even what movements shall be made when the work goes forward under the direction of the angel, who joins the third angel, in the message to be given to the world. God will use ways and means by which it will be seen that He is taking the reins in His own hands. The workers will be surprised by the simple means that He will use to bring about and perfect His work of righteousness. Those who are accounted good workers will need to draw nigh to God. They will need the divine touch. Also read Isaiah 3. It is not men of great talents and titles that are needed so much, as it is men who are great in faith, holiness, consecration, and love. Men who are great for God and great in simplicity, fidelity, and self-denial, upon such transmitting God's message, life, and blessings to humanity, and for advancing His kingdom in all the earth. Review and Herald, Feb. 20, 1930. The Spirit of Prophecy says in Patriarchs and Prophets, page 251, that the rod of Moses was a symbol of God's power. The shepherd's rod, power of God, the sheep, God's people. The shepherd's rod is an instrument which is used to catch sheep. The rod in this is an instrument which is used to catch people. What could it be? It cannot be anything else but some wonderful, plain, clear-cutting Bible truth which could not be contradicted. When it is revealed, it will produce serpents people, or converts, by reformation. But the Egyptians did the same also, for they cast down every man his rod, and they became serpents, and perhaps more in number, for every man cast his rod, but they were counterfeit. Symbols of hypocrisy on true Christians, but Moses' rod swallowed the rods of the Egyptians. Symbol of victory for true Israel. The result is opposition, but true Israel wins at last. In volume 5, page 696 we read, they did not really cause their rods to become serpents, but by magic, aided by the great deceiver, made them appear like serpents to counterfeit the work of God. Symbol of an outward appearance of Christianity by Seventh-day Adventists. But one may say, what? God's people symbolized by a serpent? Why not by sheep? If the meek and lowly Christ was symbolized by the brazen serpent in the wilderness which Moses raised up for the children of Israel, to look upon and be healed from bites of the fiery serpents, then God's people could be symbolized by a serpent as well. If the rod would have turned into a sheep, it would have spoiled the symbol, for the 144,000 are not to be sheep in the sheepfold and cared for by an earthly shepherd, but the opposite. For this reason the serpent is used, as a symbol, meaning wise, cannot be frightened, would not run away from anything, the opposite of sheep. They are to be filled with the Holy Spirit, proclaim the message and triumph with victory. And the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many people, as a dew from the Lord, as the showers upon the grass, that tarrieth not for man, nor waiteth for the sons of men. And the remnant of Jacob shall be among the Gentiles in the midst of many people, as a lion among the beasts of the forest, as a young lion among the flocks of sheep, who, if he go through both, treadeth down, and teareth in pieces, and none can deliver. Micah 5:7, 8. Death of firstborn. And Moses said, thus saith the Lord, about midnight will I go out into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sitteth upon his throne, even unto the firstborn of the maidservant, that is behind the mill, and all the firstborn of beasts. Exodus 11:4, 5. And it came to pass, that at midnight the Lord smote all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, that sat on his throne, unto the firstborn of the captive, that was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of cattle, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead. Exodus 12:29, 30. The firstborn, a symbol of a class of priesthood, a representation of Ezekiel 9:6, last part the ancient men that were before the house. From the firstborn that sitteth upon the throne to the firstborn in the dungeon, symbol of Ezekiel 9:6, slay utterly old and young, both mates, and little children, and women. Then they began at the ancient men which were before the house. The firstborn of cattle, symbol of Isaiah 63:18 and Isaiah 64:1, Numbers 26:10. In the case of Achan, God said to Joshua, neither will I be with you any more, except ye destroy the accursed from among you. How does this instance compare with the course pursued by those who will not raise their voice against sin and wrong, but whose sympathies are ever found with those who trouble the camp of Israel with their sins? Said God to Joshua, thou canst not stand before thine enemies until ye take away the accursed thing from among you. He pronounced the punishment which would follow the transgression of this covenant, and Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan the son of Zerah, and the silver, and the garment, and the wedge of gold, and his sons, and his daughters, and his oxen, and his asses, and his sheep, and his tent, and all that he had, and they brought them unto the valley of Achor. And Joshua said, why hast thou troubled us? The Lord shall trouble thee this day. And all Israel stoned him with stones, and burned them with fire, after they had stoned them with stones. Volume 3, pages 267-8. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, sanctify unto me all the firstborn. Whatsoever openeth a womb among the children of Israel, both of man and of beast, it is mine. Exodus 13:1-2. A symbol of a new priesthood, and the firstborn of cattle representing a system of support or maintenance. Should a case like Achan's be among us, there are many who would accuse those who might act the part of Joshua in searching out the wrong of having a wicked, fault-finding spirit. God is not to be trifled with, and his warnings disregarded with impunity by a perverse people. Volume 3, page 270. The Passover Lamb. Speak ye unto all the congregation of Israel, saying, in the tenth day of this month they shall take to them every man a lamb, according to the house of their fathers, a lamb for an house, and ye shall keep it up until the 14th day of the same month, and the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it in the evening. And they shall take of the blood, and strike it on the two side posts, and on the upper door post of the houses, wherein they shall eat it, and thus shall ye eat it, with your loins girded, your shoes on your feet, and your staff in your hand, and ye shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover, and the blood shall be to you for a token upon the houses where ye are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. And the plague shall not be upon you to destroy you, when I smite the land of Egypt. Exodus 12:3-13. All the ceremonies of the feast were types of the work of Christ. The deliverance of Israel from Egypt was an object lesson or redemption, which the Passover was intended to keep in memory. The slain lamb, the unleavened bread, the sheaf of first fruits, represented the Savior. Desire of Ages, page 77. The lamb represents Christ. Isaiah 53:7. The lamb roasted by fire, the Spirit of God. Genesis 15:17, Acts 2:3, Leviticus 9:24. The eating of the flesh, Christ is our life, for in him we live and move and have our being. John 6:53. The loins girded, the truth of God, the Word. Ephesians 6:14. The shoes on the feet, the preparation of the gospel. Ephesians 6:15. The staff in the hand, the sword of the Spirit. Ephesians 6:17. Ye shall eat it in haste, do not hesitate, get ready, quick delivery. Exodus 12:11. Exodus 12:34. And the people took their dough, before it was leavened, their kneading troughs being bound up in their clothes upon their shoulders. The kneading trough is the Bible. Ephesians 6:13. The dough is the Word of God it contains. Ezekiel 44:30 The type. Unleavened, the unadulterated word of God, and it must be kept as such. Revelation 22:18. The kneading troughs on their shoulders means make sure you have the whole word of God continually with you. Thus shall you depart from Egypt. Ephesians 6:13. The bondage in Egypt represents the bondage of sin. The promises of deliverance are the promises of the gospel. The power revealed in the judgments upon the gods of Egypt indicates the measure of power provided for the deliverance from the hard service of the god of this world. Review and Herald, January 23, 1930. The blood on the doorpost is the symbol of the seal. Revelation 7, Mark, Ezekiel 9, Revelation 7 and Ezekiel 9, is the same mark or seal. See Testimonies 2 Ministers, page 445. The blood being applied on the doorpost is to signify that the seal, or mark, by which the 144,000 are to be sealed, is to be visible. The doorpost and the forehead both have the same significance. We do not mean to say that it is a certain visible brand or mark on their foreheads, but a seal of character, principle, or rule, the standard being the pure word of God. Thus they apply the blood on the doorpost, and their brethren in the church could be conscious of a change. The only ones who can have the seal are those who sigh and cry for all the abominations sins that are done in the church. But if any take part and try to throw a cloak over the existing evil in the church, then they are left without the seal. Read Volume 5, pages 207-12, Volume 3, page 266. The Red Sea. The Red Sea symbolizes Isaiah 63. Edom means red. Edom is Esau, the twin brother of Jacob. His name was changed to Edom because he sold his birthright for a bowl of red pottage, and Esau himself was red. Therefore, we have Red Sea, Red Man, Red Pottage. Read Esau and Jacob, section 3. See, a symbol of people. Revelation 17:15. Pharaoh and his host, the chief instigators against Reformation. Egypt had developed an intricate ecclesiastical organization. It was proud of its religious institutions. It despised this people Israel, who did not worship according to the popular religion, and who now, under the message of reform preached by Moses, were taking their stand yet more fully to represent the truth and the law of Jehovah. Review and Herald, January 23, 1930. Basra, sheepfold the church. Micah 2:12, Isaiah 34:6. Edomites, those who sold their birthright to gratify appetite. They make their stomachs their god, violators of health reform. For further explanation see page 156, under heading Afflicted for His People's Sake. The bondage in Egypt represents the bondage of sin. The promises of deliverance are the promises of the gospel. The power revealed in the judgments upon the gods of Egypt indicates the measure of power provided for the deliverance from the hard service of the god of this world. The glorious triumph at the Red Sea foreshadows the victory which is assured to every trusting child of God. Review and Herald, January 23, 1930. Mount Sinai. In the third month, when the children of Israel were gone forth out of the land of Egypt, the same day came they into the wilderness of Sinai, and God spake all these words, saying, I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Exodus 19:1, Exodus 21:3. Here is where the 430 years ended, beginning with Abraham going out of Ur. Patriarchs and Prophets, page 760. Here is where Moses organized a church, when he appointed 70 elders, and where God spoke to the people himself. The experience at Sinai is a symbol of reorganization of the church. God himself takes charge of the flock. We read in Volume 5, page 80, we have been inclined to think that where there are no faithful ministers, there can be no true Christians, but this is not the case. God has promised that where the shepherds are not true, He will take charge of the flock Himself. God has never made the flock wholly dependent upon human instrumentalities. But the days of purification of the church are hastening on apace. God will have a people pure and true. In the mighty sifting soon to take place, we shall be better able to measure the strength of Israel. New name given to church. And unto the angel of the church of the Laodiceans write, I know thy works, that thou art neither cold nor hot, I would thou wert cold or hot. So then, because thou art lukewarm, and neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth. Revelation 3:14-16. Note, that the existence of the present name Seventh-day Adventist is conditional, otherwise the name will be spewed out of his mouth. And the Gentiles shall see thy righteousness, and all kings thy glory, and thou shalt be called by a new name which the mouth of the Lord shall name. Isaiah 62:2. And ye shall leave your name for a curse unto my chosen the 144,000, for the Lord God shall slay thee, and call his servants by another name. Isaiah 65:15. Read Testimonies to Ministers, page 300. This is where Isaiah's prophecy in chapter 52:1 will be fulfilled. Awake, awake, put on thy strength, O Zion, put on thy beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city, for henceforth there shall no more come unto thee the uncircumcised and the unclean. Also read Isaiah 4. Zephaniah 3:13. The remnant of Israel shall not do iniquity, nor speak lies, neither shall a deceitful tongue be found in their mouth, for they shall feed, and lead down, and none shall make them afraid. The remnant of Israel will not do iniquity. This prophecy has never yet met its fulfillment in the history of the church, for there have always been the unclean in the midst of her, but let us thank God for this generous promise. The scroll is making a turn. Shall we pray to God that we fall not out by the way in making the bend? Clad in the armor of Christ's righteousness, the church is to enter upon her final conflict. Fair as the moon, clear as the sun, and terrible as an army with banners, she is to go forth into all the world, conquering, and to conquer. Prophets and Kings, page 725. What is the number of Israel? It has been made clear that Israel, after the flesh, is a photograph of Israel, by the promise. In the Exodus movement, all the tribes went out of Egypt. If this is a photograph of Israel, by the promise, then all the 12 tribes must come out now as well. 12 tribes must escape the ruin of Ezekiel 9, death of the firstborn, and Isaiah 63, the Red Sea. The number of them is said to be 12,000, from each tribe, making a total of 144,000. For the reason that they have passed through a similar experience as ancient Israel, they, the 144,000, sing a new song of Moses and the Lamb. Then he remembered the days of old, Moses and his people, saying, Where is he that brought them up out of the sea with the shepherd of his flock? Where is he that put his Holy Spirit within him? That led them by the right hand of Moses, with his glorious arm, dividing the water, before them, to make himself an everlasting name. That led them through the deep, as an horse in the wilderness, that they should not stumble. As a beast goeth down into the valley, the Spirit of the Lord caused him to rest, so didst thou lead thy people, to make thyself a glorious name. Isaiah 63:11-14. This scripture cannot refer to another company and the one we speak of. What constitutes the remnant? The definition of remnant is that which is left after the separation, removal, or destruction of a part. Standard Dictionary. The beginning of the Church of Christ in the days of the apostles was not a large bulk just starting to unroll, getting smaller and smaller down through the ages, and now, being at the end of the history of the church, be the smallest portion, or that which is left. But, on the contrary, the church just began then to roll on, and had but a very small beginning. It has been rolling, and rolling, and putting on all through the ages, and the very end of the history of the church is by no means a remnant. Remnant signifies a very small portion, a fragment, or a small bit. The Master said, "The harvest is at the end of the world, the angels are the reapers. Then there is reaping to be done." Harvest means a collection of crops, to gather, store up, or garner in. According to this, the harvest is by no means a remnant, but just the opposite, for at harvest we gather in the most. The remnant of Israel must be something else than what we have thought it to be, for remnant is a small portion, or part which has left after a destruction. The destruction is the mighty shaking, sifting time which is the separation of the two classes, in the church the sealing of the 144,000 as prophesied in Ezekiel 9, and Isaiah 63. Those who escape are the remnant. The Bible gives no other definition of remnant, and the one given here. See Leviticus 5:13, 2 Kings 19:4, Isaiah 37:4, Ezra 9:8, Isaiah 1:9, Isaiah 11:11, Isaiah 16:14, Jeremiah 44:28, Ezekiel 6:8, Joel 2:32, Romans 11:5, Revelation 11:13. In the 11th chapter of Isaiah is recorded the same incident we have tried to explain here. In the 11th verse we read of the remnant which we speak of, "And it shall come to pass in that day, that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time, to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left." Isaiah 11:11. Early writings, page 270, I asked the meaning of the shaking I had seen, and was shown that it would be caused by the straight testimony called forth by the counsel of the true witness, to the Laodiceans. This will have its effect upon the heart of the receiver, and will lead him to exalt the standard, and pour forth the straight truth. Some will not bear this straight testimony. They will rise up against it, and this is what will cause a shaking among God's people. Isaiah 11:12, first part, "And he shall set up an ensign for the nations." Again we read in Isaiah 66:19, "And I will set a sign among them, and I will send those that escape of them unto the nations." The 63rd chapter has the same reference as Isaiah 59, part of verse 19, is here quoted, "So shall they fear the name of the Lord, from the west, and his glory from the rising of the sun." The sign is extensive from the east to the west, and has a meaning for the entire world. The destruction is the sign and example to the nations, and the remnant are those who are left, the 144,000. Following this we have the loud cry, the harvest, those who come up to every point, and stand every test, and overcome, be the price what it may have heeded the counsel of the true witness, and they will receive the latter rain, and thus be fitted for translation. Volume 1, page 187. But he said, "Nay, lest while ye gather up the tares, ye root up also the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest, and, in the time of harvest I will say to the reapers, gather ye together first the tares, and bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn." Matthew 13:29-30. The same thought is also supported in Patriarchs and Prophets, page 541. The Feast of Tabernacles was not only commemorative, but typical. It not only pointed back to the wilderness sojourn, but, as the Feast of Harvest, it celebrated the ingathering of the fruits of the earth, and pointed forward to the great day of final ingathering, when the Lord of the harvest shall send forth his reapers, to gather the tares together in bundles for the fire, and to gather the wheat into his garner. At that time the wicked will all be destroyed, those outside the church. Note that the separation takes place just at the beginning of harvest, also that the tares are gathered in first. The separation marks the beginning of harvest. The harvest is the loud cry of the third angel's message. Revelation 18:1. In this time of harvest the great multitude of Revelation 7:9 with the palms in their hands is gathered. While this great multitude is being made up and gathered into his barn, the reapers are binding the wicked in bundles separated, or kept apart from the church for the wrath of God. See Revelation 14:19. Cloud by day, fire by night. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of a cloud, to lead them the way, and by night, in a pillar of fire, to give them light to go by day and night. He took not away the pillar of the cloud by day, nor the pillar of fire by night, from before the people. It was not Moses that led Israel out of Egypt, but the pillar of the cloud that went before the people. And the Lord went before them to lead them in the way to go by day and by night. He took not away the pillar from before the people. Exodus 13:21-22. According to 1 Corinthians 10:4, in this pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night was Christ himself, and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. Thus we see that the Lord led out Israel himself, and not Moses. The people as well as Moses followed the cloud. All Moses did was to convey to the people the words and instructions received from the Lord. This is the experience of Israel after the flesh, which we call a photograph of Israel by promise. If this is true, then the 144,000 must experience the same in departing out from worldlings Egypt. Volume 5, page 80. God has promised that where the shepherds are not true, he will take charge of the flock himself. Patriarchs and Prophets, page 283. In one of the most beautiful and comforting passages of Isaiah's prophecy, references made to the pillar of cloud and of fire to represent God's care for his people in the great final struggle with the powers of evil. The Lord will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion and upon her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day, and the shining of a flaming fire by night, for above all the glory shall be a covering. And there shall be a tabernacle for a shadow in the daytime from the heat, and for a place of refuge, and for a covert from storm, and from rain. Thus, the idea of Israel being a photograph is supported by both the Bible and the spirit of prophecy. Joseph, type of Christ. Joseph stands as a perfect type of Christ. First of all, the name Joseph means he shall add. So Christ added the human family to the heavenly. Had any sin been recorded against Joseph, it would have spoiled the type, for Christ is not a sinner. Joseph was loved by his father, above all his brethren. Of Christ we read in Hebrews 1:9, "Thou hast loved righteousness, and hated iniquity. Therefore God, even thy God, hath anointed thee with the oil of gladness, above thy fellows." Joseph was sent down into Egypt to preserve the lives of his brethren in the 7 years of famine. Just so, Christ descended to preserve the lives of his brethren in this world of sin, in 80. Joseph was sold to Ishmaelites, who were the descendants of Ishmael, Abraham's seed, after the flesh. Just so, Christ was sold to priests, the descendants of Abraham, Israel, after the flesh. Joseph was a governor, and no man could lift hand or foot in all the land of Egypt without the knowledge of Joseph. Just so, Christ is a governor over the world Egypt, and no man can lift hand or foot without the knowledge of Christ. As there was only one above Joseph, namely Pharaoh, just so, there is only one above Christ, God, the Father. Joseph was 30 years old when he became governor. Christ was 30 years of age when anointed. As Joseph married the daughter of an idolatrous priest, just so, Christ marries his church, which is made up of idolatrous nations. As Joseph gathered the corn in the 7 years of plenty into the storehouses to feed the world in the 7 years of famine, just so, Christ gathered the word of God in the Old Testament time into the great storehouse, the Bible, to feed the world in the New Testament time. One may say, the New Testament came in 80. True, but the New Testament is only the fulfillment of the Old. Had not Joseph become a governor of Egypt before the beginning of the 7 years of plenty, it would have spoiled the significance, and the type would not then have indicated that Christ ruled before the world's history began. Thus we see Joseph is a perfect type of Christ. Pharaoh, type of leaders. The Pharaoh who honored Joseph is a perfect type of the earthly head of the Church of the Apostles. Had Pharaoh not been an Egyptian, it would have spoiled the type. Egypt, a symbol of the world, signifies an earthly leadership taken out of the world. Had not Pharaoh honored Joseph above every man in Egypt, or had he not commanded the Egyptians to go to Joseph for corn, it would have spoiled the symbol of the church leadership in the days of the apostles, for they exalted and honored Christ above every man in the entire world, also commended the Gentiles to Christ as their life-giver. If the first Pharaoh makes a perfect type of the church leadership in the days of the apostles, then we must accept the last Pharaoh, who knows not Joseph, as a perfect type of the church leadership who have turned from following Christ, their leader. Volume 5, page 217. The church has turned back from following Christ, her leader, and is steadily retreating toward Egypt. Thus Israel the true, the 144,000 became slaves under Egyptian bondage, the sins in the world. The bondage in Egypt represents the bondage of sin. Review and Herald, January 23, 1930. And the harp, and the vinyl, the tabret, and pipe, and wine, are in their feasts, but they regard not the work of the Lord, neither consider the operation of His hands. Therefore my people are gone into captivity, because they have no knowledge, and their honorable men are famished, and their multitude dried up with thirst. Isaiah 5:12-13. Israel being a type of this Advent movement is not new idea just thought of in this lesson. The whole denomination believes so, for we read in the Review and Herald of October 10, 1929, the following statements: while the Exodus movement was a great movement, the Second Advent movement will be still greater. God will take out a people, not from one nation only, but from every nation under heaven, and He will lead them into the heavenly Canaan. This Advent movement, of which the Exodus movement was a type, we believe was foretold in prophecy in the following stirring language: it shall come to pass in that day, that the Lord shall set His hand again the second time, to recover the remnant of His people, which shall be left. There shall be a highway for the remnant of His people, like as it was to Israel, in the day that he came up out of the land of Egypt. Isaiah 11:16. The word type means the same as the word photograph. The very first photo invented was called tintype. Thus we have the approval of the denomination, that Israel, after the flesh, is a photograph of Israel, by the promise the 144,000. As God called out Israel from Egypt anciently, just so now, God is calling His church out from worldlings and worldliness, to be a separate, peculiar people to His honor and glory. This does not mean another movement, but it does mean that God is to deal with the entire body, and those who escape are Israel, the 144,000. Quoting Review and Herald, May 1, 1930, every evil thing must be shaken from the movement. So it was in the Exodus movement. When there was sin among the people, the Lord did not give up that movement which He had brought out of Egypt, and start another one. He did not call the believers out, but He shook unbelief out of the movement by destruction causing their death. He purified it by setting aside from it every element that did not belong with the movement that He was leading according to His promise. On one pretext or another, unbelief and disorder moved out, while the movement itself marched on. If the Exodus movement is a photograph of the true, then the 430-year period connected with ancient Israel must be considered with the one now. The 430 years of sojourning and affliction. The 430-year period of sojourning and affliction with Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, which dates with Abraham going out of Ur, coincides with our time from the Reformation by Luther to the sealing of Israel by the promise the 144,000. Quoting Patriarchs and Prophets, page 760, the actual time spent in Egypt could have been only about 215 years. The Bible says that the sojourning of the children of Israel was 430 years. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the ancestors of the Israelites, were sojourners in Canaan. The period of 430 years dates from the promise given to Abraham, when he was commanded to leave Ur of the Chaldees. The 400 years of Genesis 15:13 dates from later period. Notice that the period of 400 years is not only a time of sojourning, but of affliction. This, according to the scriptures, must be reckoned from 30 years later, about the time when Ishmael, he that was born after the flesh, persecuted him Isaac that was born after the spirit. Galatians 4:29. Paul, in Galatians 3:15-17, says that from the making of the covenant with Abraham to the giving of the law at Sinai was 430 years. From these scriptures then, we are not to understand that the Israelites were in Egypt 400 years. See Exodus 12:40. According to this, the 430 years began with Abraham going out of Ur, and ended with Mount Sinai. Consequently, we have to take the entire period into consideration, beginning with Abraham, which has a definite time of certain existing conditions. At the beginning of the 430 years, idolatry prevailed everywhere. Abraham alone was called out. Such is the spiritual condition that marked the beginning of the prophetic period in its type. Just so the beginning of the time of the duplicate or antitype must be marked with a time of low spiritual condition. In the time of Martin Luther, we have the exact reproduction of Abraham's experience, for in Luther's time spiritual darkness and idolatry prevailed everywhere. Abraham is a fitting figure of Luther. Abraham was called of God by the spoken word, Luther by the written. Abraham is the father of faith, so is Luther. The doctrine taught by Luther was the just shall live by faith. If this is true, then the 430 years in our time began with Luther, about 1580. Luther discovered in the library of the University of Erfurt a Latin Bible, and found to his no small delight that it contained more than the excerpts in common use. Thus God, by his word, called Luther out of papal Rome. We have first a period of 400 years, and then it was extended to 430 years. We therefore have a 30-year period to deal with first. It has been stated that the 30 years ended about the time Ishmael persecuted Isaac. According to this, about the year 1530 AD, something must have been brought forth. What took place in 1530? The Augsburg Confession, a document compiled by Luther which was presented by the Protestants at the Diet of Augsburg to the Emperor Charles V, and the Diet, and being signed by the Protestant states, was adopted as their creed, and who protested against the Pope. This coincides with Sarah protesting against Agar and Ishmael when they departed from the house of Abraham, and the assurance of the covenant of promise that was made with Isaac. As Sarah protested against Agar and Ishmael, so Protestants protested against papal rule. This is just exactly what should have taken place in 1530 AD. To fit the occurrence of the prophecy, at the time Isaac was persecuted by Ishmael, Isaac was 5 years old, and at the time Jacob was born, Isaac was 60. Therefore, we add 55 years to 1530, which brings us to 1585 AD. Explanation of this period will be given later. From the birth of Jacob to the time Israel went into Egypt was 130 years. Adding this number to 1585 gives us 1715 AD. The explanation of this period also will be given later. From the time Israel went into Egypt to the birth of Moses was 135 years. Adding this to 1715 brings the total to 1850 AD. This period is marked by the birth of Moses, which was a hope, a deliverer, for Israel. What took place in 1850? The first testimony was written to the church and addressed to those who are receiving the seal of the living God. Signed, E.G. White. Thus the birth of Moses, the hope of Israel, after the flesh, coincides with the birth of the first testimony for the church, the hope of Israel, by the promise, the 144,000. Thus we see a perfect harmony in the type with antitype. See Origin and Progress of Seventh-day Adventists, page 749. Moses at the age of 40 years attempted to deliver Israel, and failed. Adding 40 years to 1850, we have 1890 AD. What happened at this time? The following statement was made by Sister White in 1892: if the people of God had gone to work as they should have gone to work right after the Minneapolis meeting, in 1888, the world could have been warned in 2 years, and the Lord would have come. General Conference Bulletin, 1892. This reference was given us by a Seventh-day Adventist minister of Los Angeles, California. About the same time, 1890, national religious liberty was organized by the denomination. Thus the attempt and failure of Moses' experience to set freedom to Israel from Egyptian bondage coincides with organizing religious liberty, and God's people failed to do their duty. National Religious Liberty Association organized July 21, 1889. Origin and Progress of SDA, page 752. 40 years later, Moses was called and sent back to Egypt, and did set Israel free from the Egyptian bondage. Adding 40 to 1890 brings the total to 1930. This period should be marked by a reformation and purification of the church, fulfilling Malachi 3 and Ezekiel 9. And it shall come to pass in that day, that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left. Isaiah 11:11. The two periods, 1585 and 1715, will now be explained. 1585 corresponds with the birth of Jacob, and 1715 corresponds with Israel going down into Egypt. The entering into Egypt with 70 souls typified the birth of Seventh-day Adventists, as explained on pages 73-74, but Seventh-day Adventism was not born until 1845. To get the truth of these two periods, we must count back to the birth of Jacob, for it is a birth that we are dealing with. We have 130 years, from the entrance into Egypt to the birth of Jacob, and 85 years, from the birth of Jacob to Abraham's departure out of Ur. Therefore, we must go backwards and subtract the first 85 years period from the going out of Ur to the birth of Jacob from 1930, and we have 1845. Thus, we get the year of the birth of Seventh-day Adventists. Miss Ellen Harmon then had her first vision, and it was about the 144,000 Israel, by the promise, and the first paper published then on the Sabbath truth was called The Hope of Israel. See Origin and Progress of Seventh-day Adventists, page 749. Now subtract the 130-year period, from the birth of Jacob to the entering into Egypt, from 1845, and we have 1715 AD, the year which was marked by Israel going into Egypt. Thus, 1715 becomes the dividing line between Canaan and Egypt, just as Christ became the dividing line between BC and AD. Note how it coincides on the chart. If these coincidences were divinely designed, then the beginning and ending of the prophecy, as on the following chart, would be correct. This is the reason why we have 1580 as the starting point of this prophecy, and if these coincidences were divinely designed, then the beginning and the endings of the prophecy, as on this chart, would be correct. See chart on Ezekiel's prophecy on page 133.